just the Dhamma talks, because it's nice to combine the meditation with the Dhamma, I find. And how do you know that you're having success in your meditation? Well, you know, if you feel just a little bit, tiny bit better after the meditation than you did when you started out, then you know that you're heading in the right way, you're getting something out of it. That's really all that you should look for in the meditation practice, that it actually makes you feel better. That will encourage you to keep on practicing. If you feel worse afterwards than you did when you started, then you need to look into what the problem is and sort it out. Some people actually feel worse. Yeah, please don't feel bad if you feel worse, because this happens to some people. Instead, try to find the causes for what the reason for that is, and then hopefully we can resolve it and we can make some progress later on. Okay, so let us come back to the suttas again. Yesterday, we started looking at right view. The idea of, because we're starting with dependent origination, it's going to the very source, the very beginning of dependent origination, which is avijja. Avijja being delusion, being the opposite of right view, the not understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Yeah? So what we're doing now is we're looking at the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the sutta which talks about the Four Noble Truths, and try to understand what they are, so that we have some grasp of what delusion is all about. And one of the first things in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is this idea of the middle way, avoiding the extremes. And that is what we had a look at yesterday. And it's kind of interesting, isn't it? You look at those extremes, and on the one hand, you have the sensual pleasures, the things that people take to be the happiness in life. On the other hand, you have the tormenting of the body. And what is so, in one way, they are extremes, but in another sense, they're not really extremes at all, as I was saying before, because both of these have to do with the body. They have to do with the senses. And as long as we either torture the body or we find indulgence in the senses, so long we're going to have an interest in that body. And that interest in the body is the problem. The interest in the senses is the problem, because it means the mind goes to the body, it goes to the senses, because it's interested in what is happening there. If you torture yourself, then you're going to have the craving to end the torture. Yeah, so the mind goes to the body. If you are finding a lot of indulgence in the body and the senses, then the mind is also going to go there. So when you avoid these two extremes, basically the body becomes irrelevant. The senses become irrelevant. You put all that aside. And when the senses become irrelevant, it means you can go inside. The ability to go inside, to let go of the world, depends to a large extent on the senses becoming irrelevant. As long as we are attached to the senses, we can't let them go. It's impossible to fully go inside. Yeah, it's very obvious when you think about it. It really has to be this way. It's not a very hard thing to understand. And when this happens, when you have this ability, when you find this middle way, what you find, that is why you find all these wonderful, amazing things on the Buddhist path. The peace of meditation, the joys and the happinesses of meditation practice, the jhana states, and all of these things that you hear about, but for most people are, you know, they're something that they are aspiring to. Not craving for, of course, but aspiring to. Then all these things exist there. Yeah, the real happiness of life actually exists when you put the body, the senses aside, and you move onto that middle path. And this is exactly why we just saw the Buddha finds the middle way. The next thing he does is practice the jhanas. Yeah, he practices deep states of stillness and bliss as a consequence of letting go. So the jhanas are the middle way. This is the middle path. They are the epitome of the middle path, because they are the result of the full practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. Once you start to understand what is going on here, it's very useful to understand this, because actually it is quite fairly obvious when you think about it. Yeah, as long as you are attached to yourself, as long as you find happiness in the senses, you're going to be attached to them. I can't see anymore. Help! I want to be able to see. Yeah, why? Because I enjoy seeing things. Seeing things is great. But in the jhanas, you have to let go of all seeing. It's as if you become blind. Yeah? Are you willing to become blind? Well, that depends on whether you are attached to your senses or not. This is how it works. of course, you're not really going blind. You're just kind of a temporary blindness. But at the moment, you're actually letting go as if you are going blind in a sense. So that is the middle way. Very beautiful. And now I want to continue on. There's a tiny little sutta that a tiny little extract from the sutta that comes just after this middle way that I was looking at yesterday. This is from the Bodhiraja Kumara Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 85, on page 13 in your little booklet there. And this is just another way of looking at the Buddha, understanding the Buddha before he became the Buddha to be. Yeah, and I just find this interesting. That's why I brought it out. So here, the Buddha has come to the house of Prince Bodhi, and then Prince Bodhi offers food to the Buddha and the Sangha. Then, with his own hands, Prince Bodhi served and satisfied the Sangha of bhikkhus headed by the Buddha with various kinds of fine food. When the Blessed One had eaten and had put his bowl aside, Prince Bodhi took a low seat, sat down to one side, and said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, Bhante, what we have thought thus, pleasure is not to be gained through pleasure. Pleasure is to be gained through pain." Yeah, this is kind of the standard view of the world. I was saying yesterday, everybody thinks that the spiritual path somehow has to do with torturing yourself or tormenting yourself. And this is precisely the view that this Prince Bodhi is mentioning here. Yeah, pleasure is to be gained through pain, is this idea. And then the Buddha says, very interestingly, "Prince, before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisattva, I too thought thus, pleasure is not to be gained through pleasure. Pleasure is to be gained through pain." So the Buddha had exactly the same view as everyone else. The Buddha also had wrong view. Yeah, the idea that you go torture yourself, and that's of course why he did all those ascetic practices. When you torture yourself, torment yourself, then you gain something on this path. The Buddha too, the Buddha to be also had wrong view. Yeah, and again, it shows us the similarities again between us and the Buddha. He started off thinking about the world in the wrong way, just like almost everyone does when we start out on the Buddhist path. So again, there is no difference there. That it kind of encourages us. Gives us some sense of confidence that we too can do this practice. So what happens after this? What happens after this is that the Buddha then explains to Prince Bodhi that there is this gradual training here. This gradual training happens in this way. And then he talks about all the happinesses of the gradual training. He talks about the happiness of being moral. Yeah, the fact that you feel, you feel the anavajjasukha, the blameless happiness, because you are blameless. So you feel happy about yourself because you live a blameless life, yeah? Very nice. And then you have the abhyaseka sukha, which is a sukha, the happiness that is unsullied. It is not mixed with bad qualities. That is when you start to even purify your mind a little bit. You have less anger, yeah? You have less desires in the world. And everybody can have less anger. It is not that hard to do. And as you develop that, you feel the unmixed, the happiness that is not mixed with kind of negative mental states. It's even more pure. And then through happiness after happiness, yeah, the Buddha shows Prince Bodhi how eventually you reach the jhana states. Of course, jhana states, they are the pure form of bliss, the purest form of bliss that you can have in samsara. And then from that, you gain awakening. And what the Buddha is pointing out is that if you look at the path in the right way, actually, happiness leads to happiness. That's what he's saying. Yeah, the happiness of virtue leads to a deeper happiness. The happiness of purifying your mind leads to the happiness of the jhanas. The happiness of the jhanas leads to the happiness of awakening. One happiness leading to another one. It's a wonderful way of looking at the Buddhist path. Yeah, it's just, wow. If this is what it's about, I'm going to do, this is what I want, yeah. It's just one thing after the other, everything developing in such a wonderful, wonderful way. Can anyone seriously not want this kind of path? it's kind of it's so obvious when you start to understand what it's all about. It's such a wonderful and beautiful path. So this is why we should always look for that happiness in our practice. We should try to understand that the five precepts are not there to torture us. Yeah, don't do this. Yeah, if you do that, you are bad. Okay, I'm not going to be bad. They are there for you to feel happy about yourself. That's the whole purpose of these things. So remember to look at this in the right way. Encourage the people around you. Say, wow, what a wonderful thing it is that you're keeping the five precepts for so long. You know, what a great thing that is. And then they start thinking differently. They think, yeah, maybe it is good. Yeah, and then you start to feel the joy of keeping the precepts rather than feeling it as some kind of oppression, which is exactly what they are not. Then you're getting down, you're understanding this path in a much, much better way here. So that is a kind of this Buddhist view of the spiritual practice, and obviously it's quite revolutionary. It's different from how most people understand the spiritual path, and that is why it is so interesting here. So that is that tiny little extract of the sutta. It's actually a long sutta. I should have put extract next to it. I forgot to do that. Now let us go back to the Four Noble Truths again. So if you come back to page 6 of the little booklet. So that was the middle way, the middle path. And now we're going to have a look at the Four Noble Truths. And this is how the first noble truth goes. This because is a noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, old age is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. Separation from what is pleasing is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. So when people read this, they say, Buddhism, don't want to be a Buddhist, too negative. So people say sometimes. Of course, the purpose of the Buddhist path, and the reason why it may sound negative in this way, is because it is also very profound. And this is really the point of this. This is the viewpoint from a point of view of the Buddha looking down. That's why the focus on suffering is so strong, because from the viewpoint of the Buddha, the world looks very different from our viewpoint. This does not mean that the path does not have a lot of happiness, as I was just saying. There's heaps of happiness there. It's just that this is like a different perspective on things. And that's why the focus is so much on suffering here. But we should really be careful about these things, yeah? I noticed that the lady who was new, she's not here, maybe too much about suffering here. I think she is, people are just coming and going a little bit, which is perfectly fine. Sometimes we have to be careful how we market Buddhism. Yeah, and this is, I think, one of those things that sometimes we don't market it in the right way. Yeah? We have to remember that when the Buddha teaches something like the First Noble Truth, he's teaching it often to monks, to people who have been dedicated to the Dhamma for a long time. Yeah, people already have a very powerful spiritual inclination. But if you teach the First Noble Truth or the Four Noble Truths to kind of people on the street, somebody, and they will say, what were you talking about? I'm not interested in that. That sounds terrible. Yeah, so we have to focus, give it another slant to be able to make it accessible to people, for them to be able to accept the Buddha's teachings. And that, of course, I think is much more to do with the idea of happiness. We all want happiness. Yes, we want to avoid suffering, but actually we also want happiness in our life. We want the joy. We want the peace. We want to feel at ease. We want to feel relaxed. We want to get along with our fellow beings around us. We want to have harmony. All of these things are what we crave for as human beings. And that is very often the things that we need to focus on when we teach these teachings. There's always two sides of the coin. Wherever we talk about suffering, happiness is just there on the other side of the coin. So marketing these teachings is so important to get that right. And one of the things that I have, for me, has been one of the most powerful insights for me in my monastic life is understanding that the Buddha's teachings are about the very meaning of life. And when I kind of got that, this is the meaning of life, then, you know, that's it. Yeah, you had it. You can't, you know, you're kind of locked onto the Buddhist path from that point on. You don't have any choice anymore. Why? Because if it is the meaning of life, you can't search any further. If you search further after you find the meaning of life, well, you haven't really found the meaning of life in that case, because you're still searching. So if you think you've found the meaning of life, that's it. And this is what was such a powerful insight for me when I started to understand these teachings. So I talk about this all the time because I think it is such a wonderful thing, and this is the kind of way of selling the Buddha's message. If other people see that this really is the meaning of life, they're going to be incredibly interested in what Buddhism has to say, because this is what everyone is searching for. So anyway, let's have a look at the first noble truth anyway, while keeping in mind that it is a profound noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering. Old age is suffering, illness is, we can sort of understand that. Death is suffering, it all makes sense. But birth, why is birth suffering? It's not as obvious why birth should be suffering. All these other things we can kind of understand. What is the problem with birth? Well, maybe when you get born, it's kind of probably not very nice to get born. Yeah, you're in your mother's tummy, quite nice and comfortable, and then you come into the world. Yeah, the world is not as friendly as your mother's tummy is. So maybe that is that's probably not very nice. Yeah, so that's probably part of it. That would be one aspect of it. But I think part of this, and to be able to understand what this is about, you need to look at this thing in a different way. And one of the ways of understanding this is to remember what the word birth actually means in Buddhism. It doesn't just mean the fact that you are born. It means rebirth in the Buddhist idea. And the Four Noble Truths, the point of the Four Noble Truths is to make an end of suffering. If birth is suffering, well, we've already been born. We can't really make an end of birth if it just means birth. The only birth we can make an end of is future birth. The whole purpose of Buddhism is to make an end of suffering. If birth is suffering, it has to mean refer to future births. In other words, it must be a reference to rebirth. So even right here in the First Noble Truth, we actually find the idea of rebirth is presented right there. And now we start to understand why this is a problem. And one of those great suttas that kind of give you an idea of this is where Venerable Sariputta is asked, what is suffering? I think I can't remember who it is, maybe his cousin or something, asks him, what is suffering, Venerable Sariputta? And what is happiness? And Venerable Sariputta answers, rebirth is suffering, not to be reborn is happiness. So very profound, this whole idea of rebirth is almost equated with the idea of suffering. There it is. I think one of the reasons why rebirth is suffering, just the very process itself, to understand that, you can imagine yourself. One of the things that you hear about often is the near-death experiences. You hear the near-death experience, you hear somebody kind of getting out of their body, and they're kind of looking down, they see their body, think, "Well, that's me. What happened? Where am I now? If that's me down there, what's going on?" When people have these kind of near-death experiences, very often they feel so light, they feel so happy, they feel as if they have been released from something heavy. The body is so heavy, now I feel released from that. We don't realize how heavy the body is because we have it all the time and we're kind of carrying it around. Until you are released from it, then you can see how heavy it actually is. There was a story, I tell these stories all the time, I've probably told this here before, but especially last year, when you have given 40 hours of Dhamma talks like we did last year, there's nothing much more to say, we said everything pretty much, but anyway. So this story was this very famous story of this woman who had a near-death experience in the United States. She had a big, massive blood accumulation in the brain, and it could an aneurysm, it was about to kind of open up, and she would have died from that if that kind of blood assembly had kind of would have burst open and would have kind of would have finished her off, basically. So they had to do an operation on her. Either she would die or they'd do this operation. This operation was apparently very, very risky, very difficult to do. And the only way they could do this was by cooling her down to about 17 degrees or something. Yeah, really, really make the body very, very cold. Because when the body is cold, it's like all the metabolism and everything kind of goes down, almost stops. And then they opened up her skull and they took out the brain and they kind of fiddled around and took up this out, put it all together again, and miraculously, it was a very risky operation, miraculously somehow she survived that operation. And while she was in this operation, yeah, she had this out-of-body experience. Wow, so nice. Yeah, she see all the doctors, what are they doing to my body down there? Hey, that's my body, what are you doing? You know, so it's very rough when you see how they do this operation. They kind of saw open your skull, yeah. It's really, really kind of rough. And but she said then there came a point when she had to come back down into her body again. She had an outer body, felt so happy. And she resisted. She did not want to go back into her body. She could see that this body wasn't really worthwhile getting back into. Yeah, it kind of was kind of blood everywhere. It would look terrible. And she said afterwards that because the body had been cooled down to 17 degrees, when she got back into her body, it felt like coming back into a refrigerator, she said. She got back into the refrigerator, yeah, the 17 degrees, and everything was so incredibly cold inside her. But this gives you some idea that the body is just this very heavy thing, this very kind of cumbersome thing that we carry with us all the time. And this is one of the reasons why when you do a meditation practice, you can let go of the body, why you feel so free. There's a freedom with that. Just a little bit of allowing the body to subside, yeah, a little bit of more peace in the body has a very powerful sense of freedom about it. And that is what that is all about. So you can imagine yourself, yeah, here you are, you finally got rid of this body, and you feel so free and liberated from it. And then you can see, you can feel how your the rebirth process is happening, yeah, and you're about to get reborn into another body. You don't want that. Yeah, you can see how this, because at this point, when you are kind of in the in-between state, in-between lives, and by the way, according to the suttas, it seems to be very quite clear that there is such an in-between state, known as the antarabhava. Antara means between, bhava means existence, in-between existence. At that point, you can see your past life, yeah? And now you can see how you're about to be reborn again. You feel happy because you left the body behind, but you can see how this whole process carries on. You get a glimpse into what samsara is all about, yeah? You see the rebirth process going from one life to the next one, and you start to understand at that point what is happening. And that is why I think it is so terrifying, because now you get a glimpse into this whole process of going on and on and on and on, yeah? You understand if it's happening this life, well, it means it's probably happened before as well. And you have this incredible resistance, and it actually is quite unpleasant, the idea of being reborn. Even if you're going into a pleasant realm, this whole process just seems very negative. So I think this is part of the problem of birth and why it is suffering, why it is problematic. Yeah, you're being kind of forced to do something that you don't really want to do. And there is this other nice little story, cute little story. Adam Brahm tells this story. I don't know if it is true or not. And sometimes these stories, you wonder where they come from. But this story, this was apparently a small story in an American newspaper somewhere. Yeah, that was, this child had been born. And according to this story, as soon as this child had been born, it opened its mouth and said, "Oh no, not again." imagine that happening. Yeah. Whoa. Oh no, not again. And that could have been part of the same thing, yeah? This sense that, oh no, this is happening again. You understand the broader picture. You start to understand the problem of samsaric existence at that point. It's kind of strange because most of our lives we don't understand the problem of samsara. We are kind of trapped in this life. We cannot see the broader picture. But at that point there, there is like an opening, a possibility of seeing something more. And that is what makes that intermediate existence a bit fascinating. Yeah. So this is birth. Yeah, this is why birth is a problem. Otherwise, it's kind of strange why birth is in there. Birth seems very different from old age and death. Yeah, it's kind of a bit hard to fathom. Yes, sir. Please, sir. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay, sure, yeah. So you're saying that when you are kind of born, that you have all of these things that you have to learn, you are vulnerable, you are so dependent on your parents and everything around you. If they don't look after you properly, you have a problem and all this kind of thing. I think that's probably part of it, you know, that's probably part of the thing. Yeah. But I think in one sense, when you are there, you know, once you are there, kind of when you're a child, you know, and all this, I don't think you really understand that it is suffering at that point. I think it's even worse the moment you are about to get reborn and you realize you have to do everything over again. Huh? Yeah, remember, you see now I'm going to have to do, just like you say, I'm actually have to do all of these things again. I'm going to have to go through all of these stages again, just like I did in my life, last life. And you think, I don't want to go through all of that again. It's terrible. As you say, you're feeling vulnerable, feeling that you have to learn the most basic things, yeah, in life. You have to learn. You're taught by your parents. I think you have a point. And I think, so all of these things kind of come together in that way and make it so difficult and so hard. Yes, sir. Are you Jennifer, is that right? Where are you?
Doris.
See, this is so terrible. I haven't learned the names of you all yet. Okay. So, but the first one again, the bardo. Are you asking if the bardo state is real? So you're asking whether that is a real thing or not? Sure. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So sorry for getting your name wrong. So the bardo state, the Tibetan idea of bardo state, the bardo is like an intermediate state. Yeah, you die, and then you go into the bardo, and you hang out there for a while, and you get reborn afterwards. Is there such a thing? Does it agree with kind of how we look at things in Theravada Buddhism? And in the kind of classical Theravada Buddhism, the idea is that when you die, you get reborn straight away. That is the kind of the traditional Theravada Buddhist way of looking at things. That is what you find, you know, if you follow the traditional view, that's actually what you find. But what is interesting is that sometimes the traditional Buddhist views, Theravada views, are actually different from what the Buddha taught. So if you go to the suttas, Theravada doesn't mean always the word of the Buddha. Theravada means all the history of Theravada teachings. It means the Abhidhamma. It means the Visuddhimagga, the commentaries, and all these kind of things. It's much more than just the word of the Buddha. So sometimes there is a contradiction between the word of the Buddha and the Theravada tradition. Yeah. So, and if you go to the word of the Buddha, it is, to me, it is very quite obvious that the Buddha is talking about an intermediate state. For example, there's one famous sutta where the Buddha says that he's asked the question, after you die, but you haven't yet been reborn, what is it that sustains you at that time? And the Buddha says, at that time, what sustains you is craving. Pretty obvious that there's some kind of intermediate state. You don't just go, after you have died, but you haven't yet been reborn. In that period, what is it that sustains you? Craving sustains you. So the Buddha obviously saying that there is such a thing as an intermediate state. And there is a lot of things like, a lot of little suggestions like that in the suttas that seem to be fairly strong, that there is an intermediate existence. So I take it that the Tibetans are right about that there is a bardo, and I think that is supported by the Buddha, and I think that the development of Theravada in later times actually, I think they must have gone astray. Either that, or they are interpreting it in a different way, or something like that. Maybe they are interpreting the intermediate state as a kind of rebirth in its own right. There are different ways of looking at this, obviously. But basically, the idea of an intermediate state seems to be correct. And how long it lasts, I think it will vary enormously on the kind of karma you have made and kind of being you are. And for some rebirth, there may not be an intermediate state. Some beings, it may just happen automatically. If you have very strong karma, you just go poof, swoosh, off to the Brahma realm, and you just chill and you just enjoy yourself for a long period of time. If you made very bad karma, you may get bang, the earth just opens up and swallows you up and you kind of disappear, as it sometimes says. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be meant literally, I don't think so, but maybe that's what it feels like, when you get reborn in a very bad realm. But generally speaking, it takes a bit of time. You die, and we're going to have a look at the sutta about this later on. You die, and then it's almost as if you reflect on your life, and you think, well, it's almost like you, like as Brahma says, you send yourself to your own future destination, because you judge yourself, you judge your actions, and by doing that you then decide what you deserve and what you don't deserve. So that is the that is roughly about the some idea anyway about the intermediate existence. So how should we send ourselves somewhere? Should we kind of decide, I want to be human, I want to be a deva, I want to be a dog? Don't aspire to be a dog. That's bad idea. So just remember. I think it's aspiration doesn't matter so much. When the Buddha talks about rebirth, you can see this in the Sankhara Upatti Sutta. But when the Buddha talks about rebirth, it's almost always about karma. So what matters is that you just keep on, just live well, make good karma. And that is what really matters. And I would say that, generally speaking, just allow the rebirth process just to happen by itself. What you really want to do, if you want to continue your practice in the future life, what the Buddha says you should do, you should learn as much about Buddhism as possible, take your practice as far as you possibly can in this life. Then when you get reborn, you recognize the Buddha's teachings, and that is how you can continue. So this is how you continue. But if you try to make aspirations, may I be reborn as a nun or something like that, or a monk or whatever, then it may not work out. Sometimes we mess things up. Sometimes there's too much craving involved, too much desire, and we actually make it, we mess up the whole process rather than just allowing things to happen. So I would say, just learn as much as about Buddhism as you can, and that will give you a natural inclination of the mind in the right way. And then make lots of good karma, which is part of the path anyway to make good karma. It just means being kind and all these kind of things. And then things kind of tend to work out in the best possible way. Okay. So that is birth. So old age is suffering here. Not aging, but old age. Why is old age suffering? Well, it's pretty obvious. The body is falling apart. And things get slowly getting worse and worse. We don't have anyone who is incredibly old here. Huh? Yeah, not even old age. There's no old age. There's no real old age here. Huh? Yeah. But you can see it already starting to happen fairly early on. Yeah, gradually it's kind of declining. Yeah? And of course, when you look at people who are really old, yeah, sometimes it's you can see the problems. Yeah, after a while you can't do anything for yourself anymore. After a while you can't see, you can't hear, you can't taste, you can't walk. What is it? Ajahn Brahm says, the only thing that never actually dies down is the mouth. Yeah, you can always talk. Talking can always work. So, but all the other things, they can tend to die away. Ajahn Brahm is very funny here. But it comes to a point you can't even talk either. Yeah, you get so old, everything kind of stops. So you can see why that is unpleasant. It's unpleasant because we attach to so many things. We attach to our appearance. We attach to our ability to be intelligent. We attach to all of these things in the world. And suddenly we can't do those things anymore. And it challenges our ego. It challenges our sense of who we are when things are declining like that. And this is why I think all of this, you know, look at all the people in the world who use all this kind of, you know, facelifts and Botox and that sort of stuff to kind of keep appearances, you know, the same. Yeah, it's a denial basically of the process of aging. Yeah, you don't want that process, and you are denying it. It's not very. As a Buddhist, I would not recommend that kind of stuff, because it's much better to accept nature as it is and go with the flow and learn from that, rather than being in denial about these things. It's a much more powerful chance to actually learn about reality and use this process of old age as something positive. Anyway, I'll come back to this in a second, the idea of old age. Illness is suffering, yeah? It's very obvious. When you are healthy, you run around, yay, I'm healthy, and then you get your illness. Once you have a fever and you lie in bed, you feel sometimes feel terrible. Yeah, you know what it's like. I know you all think that I'm ill. I'm actually not ill at all. It's just a little bit of a cold. It's nothing. Yeah, this is zero. So don't worry about that, please. So illness is bad. Death is bad. Yeah, death really challenges so much in us because we have to let go of almost absolutely everything. Now this is death experience, very powerful in Buddhism to reflect a little bit on death, precisely because it's such a challenging time. A lot of spiritual growth can happen just by the contemplation of death. One of the most powerful things in life is the idea of dying. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. Yeah, every time you kind of have to do things you don't want to do. You have to be with people you don't really feel it's nice to be with. Have to suffer pain in the body that you don't really want to suffer. Yeah, union with what is displeasing is all these things in life that we don't really want. And it's every day there's a little bit. Yeah, some days are much worse. Big things happen, but other days small things. Every day small things happen that are displeasing. Yeah, so life is full of this, and sometimes full of big ones. Separation from what is pleasing. This is the opposite. You are attached to things, or you are enjoying yourself, and suddenly nature comes and snatches it away from you. Oh no, that was so nice. That was really, really good. This is what I'm hoping by the end of this retreat. Yeah, you're going to say, this is going to be the it's going to be separation from what is pleasing. Yeah. So when you come. Ideally, you should have a little bit of suffering. Yeah. Oh no, the retreat has gone so fast. It happened so quickly. This is what happened when I was here last year. People saying, oh no, it's already gone. Yeah, it was 9 days. I've been talking for 40 hours, for goodness sake. Yeah. And then people say, oh no, it happened. It goes so fast. It's already gone already. It was so nice to be here. Yeah. So remember that now. Yeah, it's going to happen very, very quickly. This is going to be over and it's going to be gone. Separation from what is pleasing. Yeah. And if you're not enjoying this retreat, then at the end you're going to say, yay, you know, the union from what is displeasing is finished, yeah? So now I can go back home and I can do whatever I want. You know, this bloom and this dhamma is just too profound. I don't really want to, not sure if I can understand this anyway. So you go back home and you're happy. So, you know, anyway, so that kind of, this is what this is about. So, not to get what one wants is suffering, yeah? And this is what I was talking about the other day, the idea that we have so many goals in life. We strive towards things, yeah? At university, at school, we strive. Your parents are pushing you along. Work harder. You're not getting A's in every subject, yeah? I want to see A's everywhere in every subject. parents are always a bit like this. And then you strive in your work life to make more money. You strive to climb the career ladder, always having some goal in sight. Yeah, then you get your own kids, and you want your own kids to succeed in school, etc., etc. There's always a goal somewhere, and sometimes we don't reach those goals. We don't get what we want. Yeah, we can't get there. There's something hindering us. Remember your children. These children you get, where do they come from? Are they really your children? They are beings with their own samsaric history, with their own karmic background, with their own habits, all these things. And when they grow up, you can only have a little bit of control. Most of the things, most of the personality is already shaped in the past. You can only do a little bit to kind of change your children. So because of that, if you rely too much on these results, you're going to suffer as a consequence, because an orphan, they're not going to happen that way. That's why what I was saying yesterday, focus instead on the process. The process is what matters. If the result happens or not, you don't have any control over that orphan, but you can do the process in the right way. And very interesting thing is that if you do the process in the right way, with kindness, with compassion, without defilements, without anger, all of these things, then very often the result actually comes out anyway in a good way, because the process was correct to start with. This is kind of the weird thing. When we don't attach so much to the result, often the result happens anyway. And then you think, yeah, now I've got it. I don't attach to the result. I just do the process. Then the result happens, yeah? This is the way I'm going to get the result. But that means you're attaching to the result again, yeah? So you see that you have to be careful there. Otherwise, you kind of trick yourself into a kind of the wrong way of thinking in this way. Yeah. So that is what that is about. Very often, we can't have things the way we want them. And this is, of course, a very big problem in life. And then the last one here is, in brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging, or if you like, the five personality aspects that are affected by attachment, these are suffering. Yeah. And this is, in a way, the most profound part of this. And maybe I will talk a little bit more about this afterwards, because this is actually quite interesting. For those of you who are new to these teachings, I'm not sure if... I want to talk a little bit about these aggregates, just to talk about what they mean. Because the word aggregate in English, usually the way it's used these days, it means a pile of sand. That's aggregate. Yeah, obviously doesn't mean that here. So talk a little bit about what that is about. But before I do that, I want to discuss a little bit more about old age, illness, and death, and also the union with the displeasing and separation from what is pleasing. And to do that, I want to go back to move forward again to another sutta, which comes on page 14. This is a sutta called Themes, and it deals directly with these issues. Page 14 in your little booklet. Is coffee, is that good for colds? Does anyone know? Yes. Vitamin C, coffee? No? Vitamin C? That's not the same, right? Is it bad for colds, is it? You think that? Really? Okay. Maybe that's why I start getting worse once I have coffee. Maybe I should have something else. Ginger tea is better. I have ginger tea every day, actually. So, yeah. This is kind of nice. When you become a monk, you have so many mothers, yeah? Everybody looks after you. It's really kind of sweet. Very, very sweet when you become a monk. Okay, themes. So this is going just a little bit into more depth about the contemplation on sickness, old age, and death, because these are very, very important in Buddhism. And I would really recommend all of you to reflect a little bit on this, because it is very, very useful on the Buddhist path. And whenever I do teach a meditation retreat, usually the way I teach the suttas, I usually do more of a meditation retreat, and there's only two sutta readings per day, but because here it's a bit more difficult to have a proper meditation retreat, we intensify the course a little bit. But this, I always teach this on meditation retreats, because it is a very useful contemplation to combine with your meditation practice. It's very good for letting go, for purifying your mind. So that's why I want to talk about these things in a bit more detail there. So bhikkhus, there are these five themes that should be reflected upon by a woman or a man, by a householder or one gone forth. What five? A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth should often reflect thus. I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth should often reflect thus. I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. A woman or a man, a householder, one gone forth should often reflect thus. I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. A woman or a man, a householder, one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I must be separated and parted from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. A woman or a man, a householder, one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am the owner of my kamma, the heir of my kamma. I have kamma as my origin, kamma as my relative, kamma as my resort. I will be the heir of whatever kamma, good or bad, that I do. So these are these five themes. And what is interesting here is how universal they are. You know, the Buddha says, by a woman or a man. Notice how woman comes first there. Yeah, we often say Buddhism is kind of male, sometimes a bit male-oriented, but for once you get the woman first, yeah? So now you can rejoice in that one. That's a good thing. It's a little bit more equality. But not only is it a woman or man, but also by a householder or one gone forth. So whether you are a monastic or not, yeah? These are contemplations that are very powerful for everyone. The Buddha is specifically saying that. Of course, this is true for the whole of the Dhamma, but there are certain things that are more applicable, perhaps, for householders than for monastics. Like, you know, the asubha practices, I wouldn't recommend that for householders. And other things, but this here is specifically said to be applicable for everyone, and that makes it kind of interesting here. And then the Buddha gives these five themes, and this is just a summary of the five themes that you see there, and then he goes on to explain them in detail just below. So let's just go straight into those details and see what the Buddha has to say. For the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one go forth, often reflect thus? So why are we doing this? What's the point? I am subject to old age, I am not exempt from old age. In their youth, beings are intoxicated with their youth, and when they are intoxicated with their youth, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with youth is completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am subject to old age, I am not exempt from old age. So the idea here, intoxication, what does it mean to be intoxicated? And what it means is that you don't see clearly, yeah? This is what intoxication means. If you are drunk on alcohol, how do you feel? You feel a lack of clarity. You can't really think properly anymore, yeah? I don't know if you have ever been drunk. I remember, this is a long time ago, right? Not when I was a monk, yeah? But remember when I was a student at university, I was studying engineering. Engineering students are famous for being wild animals, yeah? So we were a little bit wild animals in our engineering, as engineering students. At least in my university, I had really crazy, some crazy people there. And also very bright people, yeah, at the same time. Bright and crazy combined, you can imagine. So, getting really drunk sometimes, and what a terrible, actually, when I think back, it felt so terrible. You're completely out of control, you know. I really don't know what you're doing, can't tell up from down or left from right or sometimes. And, of course, it diminishes your ability to think clearly, to have clarity about what is right and wrong. when one of the main reasons why we have not drinking as a precept is because it diminishes your ability to understand what is right and what is wrong. You start doing crazy things once you are drunk. But there are many sources of intoxication in Buddhism. Alcohol is only one of them, but there are many other sources of being intoxicated. We get this, our perceptions are distorted because we kind of are intoxicated by the world, yeah? Sensual pleasures are intoxicating as well. You kind of go enjoying yourself with sensual pleasures, and you kind of say, yeah, what's the problem, just enjoying myself, yeah? And then gradually they take over, and eventually you start doing bad things because of those sensual pleasures. And the same thing with being young. Yeah, I'm young. Yeah, I'm strong. I'm healthy. And old age kind of seems far away. What's the point of bothering with old age when you're young? Yeah. And who's the youngest person here? Jerry, are you the youngest person here? I'm not sure. So, what's the point of thinking about this? But the point is, these things happen pretty fast. Yeah, I am now, well, how old am I now? 53 or something? Yeah, it seems like yesterday I was only 20. Things happen so quickly. Yeah, bang, it's all gone. And so the right way of thinking about this is to remember that time is always short. Time is always at a premium. If you want to build up enough spiritual qualities in your life, now is the time to do it. Not to wait until you're old. Now is the opportunity. Before you know it, it's too late. And the way that I like to think about this old age and all of these things is that old age is already inside of us. The moment you are born, old age is already within you. So waiting to come out, yeah, is the opposite side of the coin of youth. Youth always implies old age. One cannot exist without the other. If you're always young, well then old age doesn't exist. But the fact that so then youth doesn't exist either. But if youth exists, old age is already implied. It's already inside of us. It's already just waiting to kind of blossom, come out, come forth. So it's already there. So can you feel that old person inside of you? Yeah, this is the question. Are you ready to be old? Is it okay? Can you deal with that? If you are old already, in a sense we are neither young nor old. We're just always changing from one thing into the next one. We are all of these things and none of these things. Once you get this feeling that actually it's already part of me, it is just waiting to come out, you start to identify less with the idea of being young. If you already are old, then the identity as youth kind of fades away. Can you identify with being old, Jerry? Kind of, no, can't? Okay, so there's an exercise for you, yeah? So you can try it out. When you are like 80, yeah, and whatever, and we all need, it's not just when you are young, we all need to do this, to remind ourselves of these things. And then you start, your mind settles down, and the way that you know that you are successful in this kind of contemplation is because your mind becomes more clear. You get more clarity about this, you remember what is important in life, yeah? You think, wow, I really have to get on with being kind and doing good things because that is what life is really on all about. So once you get that, then actually that is the outcome. The outcome is we become better people. This is the purpose of this. The purpose is not to kind of end up despairing. I'm already old. Oh no, my life is gone. Yeah, what a terrible thing it is. No, not at all. It's actually the exact opposite. It's about enabling us to live well, to do what is right, and that gives rise to happiness in a far deeper sense. That is the purpose of this. So the intoxication is abandoned. Yeah, you don't hold on to the idea of youth so much more. And the same thing with illness. It's exactly the same thing. I don't even have to read it out, the whole thing, because it's exactly the same thing with illness. Whenever you are ill, well, that's to be expected. You know, the human bodies, they are ill. We have health. Both things happen. Nothing goes wrong when you are sick. When you're sick, everything has gone right. That's what you should expect. And so, you know what Ajahn Brahm says? Yeah, he said that when you go to the doctor, he says, "Doctor, doctor, something is right with me. I'm sick again today." Yeah. So, and then the doctor sends you to the psychiatrist straight away. Yeah, and better sort this person out. But it's true. Yeah, and it's so obvious that sickness and health always have to go together. So don't, when you're ill, remember this nothing has gone wrong. This is life. Life is like this. Sometimes being absolutely miserable out of it actually is part of what life is about. Can't avoid that. And instead of saying something is wrong with me, it gives you an insight into the nature of life. Don't think that insights are always some kind of profound thing that you have in meditation practice. Often insights are small little things in daily life when you realize actually sickness is part of this life. When you understand that, it makes life a little bit less worthwhile, yeah, because you understand actually you cannot avoid these things. This is part and parcel of what life is about. And it makes you not so attached to life anymore because you see the negative side of life. If we think that something is wrong when we get sick, well then that is a delusion that kind of reinforces this idea of how wonderful life is when and in the face of reality. So this is just about illness. But the most important one, actually, let's not go there yet, because that's the death contemplation, and we need a bit more time than just 2 minutes to look at the death contemplation, because it's very interesting and very, very powerful. But you can see what is going on with these contemplations here. They are all about getting a more realistic view of existence. And the more realistic our view of reality is, the more clarity we have. And this is a very important part of what we call vipassana in Buddhism. Vipassana has all kind of different levels to it. But if you are able just to remember that sickness and health are two sides of the same coin, that old age and youth are two sides of the same coin, death and life are two sides of the same coin, and you are able to use that to clear your mind a little bit, that is already vipassana. Yeah? Don't think of vipassana as some kind of really something profound. Oh yeah, this is really profound. There's all kind of levels with this, and these basic levels are some of the most important levels because they allow the whole path to flourish, the whole path to happen. And it is from there that the deeper levels of vipassana come later on. So vipassana is very broad. It all only means really the idea of seeing things clearly, or seeing things in the right way. That is really what it is all about. Anyway, I'm going to stop there for a few minutes, just to have a short break, and then see you back again about 10:15.